So I'm speaking about back when I was a student, you know, which was a few years ago, and how every semester you get to the end and it's like this slog and you think, I can't sit through another lecture. And, oh, this is so boring. See, I haven't forgotten what it's like to miss me. And then I decided, you know, you go through this process, and you all will, that whatever field you get into, you'll get passionate about it, your specialty. So it will happen. Might not be OB, might not be psych, I don't know, because those were not my favorite classes, and then I ended up teaching OB. So anyway, I just want you to know there is light at the end of this tunnel. So two more weeks. So before I pull the screen down, that didn't show up very well. I realized, in my mind, I always want to call every room in McDonald 163. This is not 163. It's 115. So just to clarify, the last exam will be here on Monday of finals week at 1 o'clock in this room. Okay? And we'll have the full 2 hours. So speaking of the last exam, I just had a request, and I'm happy to do a review session to go over things. The time and date I'm looking at would be Thursday, December 6th. Does that work? 11 o'clock in the morning?
You have pals.
No, so, what? Okay, you guys tell me, is there a time that week that would work for all of you? Or those of you who would be interested?
Don't we have class next week? Can we do it Monday, either before class starts? Or
I can't do it next Monday before class because I have a faculty meeting.
Okay.
Can't miss those.
Yeah, what about after class?
After class next Monday, let me look. That would be the 3rd of December. Oh, I can't believe it's almost December. Yeah, I think that would work. So you want to do it then?
Sure.
Okay, so I'll just plan to hang around, and if you've got questions, if there's something that I did not make clear, or you want to just know more about anything, just ask me. Okay, all right, and I'll go through the lectures and kind of have an outline of the important points that I want to make, or that I think the concepts I really want you to be able to take with you from this class. Yes, Carol.
Well, going through that study guide really helped us on your exams, do you think?
You know, here's how the exams, again, they're going to be just like what you've seen. There's not going to be anything different. What is different is, as I've told you, this course builds. So think back to the very first week, what you learned about postpartum hemorrhage. Now we're at the end, and you should be able to identify all the different types of patients that might be at risk for postpartum hemorrhage. Advancement, I think I put this on D2L, advanced maternal age. What are the risks? We've talked about that with various disorders throughout the semester. So on the one hand, am I going to make it cumulative? Kind of, because it's information that you should know. I'm not going to go back and find some weird little thing. It's broad concepts about OB, about care of postpartum women, about, you know, I don't put a lot of questions about labor. You've covered that. I'm more interested, as I said, I tell students this every semester, if you take nothing else from OB, what's the number one thing I want you all to know? That's all right, I can see your lips moving. See, that counts.
Didn't she say the number one thing that we should know about is postpartum hemorrhage?
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you. That is the number one thing, because that's something, oh geez, that's me, that's really rude. Let me turn it off. I think it's one of my kids. They'll just have to wait. Actually, it was Bobby Smith. Okay. So those are the sorts of things that I really look at, is your broader understanding. Nursing care, both on the psychosocial side and on the actual physical side, because as you've all seen, a lot of what we deal with in this class is more almost psychosocial than physical, because again, it's a younger, healthier population. So I'll, you know, we'll do that review session, and I think that that will really clarify stuff. So for my groups, I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet for final evals. And if you would get these done or signed up, if these times do not work for you, let me know either at the break or after class, and I'll arrange another time. I do have some other times I can do it. I just thought I'll pick some blocks that hopefully will work for all of you. And then my understanding, I know now I feel like I'm kind of maybe losing it. I don't know, maybe I am. It's the end of the semester. I lost my course schedule. I have it on D12, but the one I write on all the time. So this week is going to be A and B doing sim lab, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And presentations?
No.
Okay, so C and D is going to do presentations this week?
Correct.
And then next week, A and B does presentations?
Correct, yes.
Perfect. I'm going to write myself a note. Stacy had told me she had to make some changes, and we hadn't communicated that very well, so I just thought I'll ask all of you. So I'll just plan to see you. It doesn't really matter for presentations, because just come when you're supposed to come. SimLab, I will schedule you in smaller groups. Bobby will not be here this week, and I will just make it smaller. We're going to do some fun stuff, I hope, again. So that being said, any other questions at this point? Yes?
I'm a little confused for final evals. Are we filling out the sheet, or do you?
I want you guys to fill them out. You fill them out. And if you're in my group, I apologize. I had fully intended to get those done and back to you today, but I had way too much free time over Thanksgiving, and I was with one of my children, and I don't see him very often, so I really soak up all that time. I will get those done tonight, and I will get those to you guys tomorrow if you're signed up for this week. If you're next week, I'll get it to you. So, and as we agreed, did I say I give you how many points for doing it?
Five.
I knew somebody reminded me.
It was five.
Five. Yeah, no, I knew that. I had to yank your guys' chains a little bit. So I will promise to give you those points. So grades, I'm putting in as scores as I get stuff. I got a bunch of stuff done. I'll get those in. Wendy, if she's your clinical instructor, she's getting feedback to me. So anything, gestational age, breastfeeding, all that, I'll get those points in. So hopefully by the end of this week, if not sooner. I always try to kind of, you know, put out the long projection and then exceed that. You'll have a good idea where you stand in class. So, yes.
So A and B have a sim lab tomorrow. And is there another sim lab for C and D?
No, it's the one that C and D did before.
That's what I thought.
We got off kilter because of break and stuff. Normally by now we would have finished them all, but because you got election day off and some other things. That's why there's just this one. So, and then we'll all be caught up. Okay?
And just to clarify, Abstract 319 for presentations?
Yes, so we'll have the classroom all morning. As I said, I will provide cups, plates, utensils, napkins, all those things. And you may bring whatever you would like for food. So. It really is a fun morning. Everybody does a really good job. It's fun to hear your presentations. It's a nice chance for me to sit and not talk, and you get to listen to each other. And it's a celebration for all the work you've done. So we have a lot of fun.
I just had a quick question on the breakdown of the lecture. So today, healthcare, mature women, infertility.
Yeah.
And then are we knocking out genetics as well?
I don't know if I'll get to genetics today, but by next week we'll get that NAS.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get all those done.
Okay.
So, interestingly, just this morning, I don't know if anybody else heard this, but in China, they just delivered a set of twins that are the first genetically edited ever human beings. And they used CRISPR technology. Have you guys heard of that? CRISPR technology was developed about 2 years ago. It's used a lot for treatment of certain cancers. So, for instance, some of the newer drugs for lung cancer that have extended life, those were developed as a result of this CRISPR, and I can't remember what CRISPR stands for, gene editing technology. Well, now they've applied it to creation of two human beings, a set of twins. So brings up a lot of ethical stuff. It's actually been outlawed in the United States 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, 2015, Congress passed a law saying that could never be done here. So lots of interesting stuff going on. That's why I said every day on OBGYN, this morning there was a thing about bed rest in pregnant women. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
And what did they conclude?
That there's no data that says it helps.
No benefit, no data. Yeah. So, but we still see it being done. So. Anyway, like I said, every morning I hear something about OBGYN. Okay, let me get this turned on. We'll get going.
Friday the 30th, or are you doing Tuesday the 29th?
Or Thursday the 29th?
This is what happens when I try to multitask. Okay, so I meant the 20. Okay. And then next week. Okay, thank you. Always good to clarify.
Sorry, this computer is really, my screen is black, so I don't know what's going on. Well, sorry, my screen is died up here. So it reminds me of when I was an ICU nurse, there was one particular piece of equipment that we said we were going to take to the roof of the hospital, to the helipad. This computer needs to go. So I'm just trying to figure out if I can get the slideshow. Well, we'll make do. The information is still here. So, ta-da! We're going to talk about, we're switching gears. We're going to talk about healthcare of mature women, as I like to call them, myself being one. And we're also going to talk about infertility. And you'll see a little bit where those two overlap. So let's get going here. Sorry, I have to turn around. Okay. So this is commonly known as the time in life as menopause. An older term that they used to use was the climacteric. You hardly ever hear that. But again, these are just some facts you want to know. So the average age is around 51, 52 years old in the United States. And the reason that's important to know is more and more adults are living longer. So how many of you in here know someone who's 90 years old in their 90s? How about people in their hundreds? Yeah, and it never used to be that way. My sister-in-law was just telling me she happens to live in another county in the state. Anyway, at the local assisted living facility, they actually have a patient who is 107. And she folds laundry every day. She does the laundry for them. So we're seeing that. People are going to live longer. So odds are, unless you work in pediatrics, but even there you're going to see grandparents most likely, you're going to encounter a lot of people, women over this age, so half the population. And there's some specific needs, health needs you want to be aware of. Again, it's important to be able to define it. And it's defined as one full calendar year with no menstrual cycles. And that's important to help patients understand. We'll talk about perimenopause, and women, oftentimes their cycles will start spacing out, and they think, yay, I don't need to worry about contraception anymore. And then they get one of those late in life surprises, as we call them. So it can happen. But also there's something known as surgical menopause. And it's important to understand the distinction of that, because you'll meet people or women, not people, but women, who will tell you they've had a hysterectomy, so they're menopausal. But actually, you're not menopausal just from having a hysterectomy. If you've retained your ovaries, which many times they do leave them in because there are health risks associated with oophorectomies or removal of the ovaries. So a lot of times women are, they've had their uterus removed, but they're still having cycles. And where you see that exhibited is sometimes younger women have a hysterectomy. For instance, postpartum hemorrhage, as I said, that kind of weaves throughout the course. They may have required a hysterectomy to stop bleeding after postpartum hemorrhage, but there was no reason to take her ovaries out. So they'll retain their ovaries because they need those hormones for the rest of their life. But then those women, as they age, they will go through the same symptoms of menopause.
even though they haven't maybe had a uterus for 10 or more years. Perimenopause is that time leading up to it, and it's actually anywhere 2 to 10 years before, but it also can occur in women as young as 35 or 40. So a lot of times women, as they approach that age in life, that later 30s, mid 40s, they'll notice changes in their cycles and they'll start wondering, oh, is this menopause? Probably not, but they are approaching it. And of course, really all menopause is it's the cessation of function of the ovaries in terms of monthly menstrual cycles. So that's why it's a declining function. And I have a joke I'll show you in a moment about that. Interestingly, it occurs earlier in women of non-European descent. So Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, Asians, but also women who smoke often will go into this time in their life at an earlier age. And poor nutritional intake. You know, really, poor nutritional intake, I don't know anything it's good for except maybe excessive weight loss. So, all right, I'll do my little gymnastics turn here. Okay, so what are the symptoms? Well, the number one that everybody associates with menopause is hot flashes and night sweats, and it occurs in about 75% of all women. You'll hear a lot of women themselves make jokes about it. You'll see lots of products advertised. Interestingly, this was predicted probably, oh gosh, maybe 15 years ago. I read an article in, you know, the font of all knowledge, USA Today, probably in an airport somewhere, that it was being predicted that because there was the baby boomer generation and so many of them, that a lot of products were going to be directed that way, and you're seeing that. You can now buy special pillows that are supposed to keep you cooler at night. Bed sheets keep you cooler at night. The other thing they predicted was a change in the type of lighting in restaurants, things like that. So anyway, I'm getting off track here, so I'll get back on. But as a result of hot flashes, night sweats, they usually occur during the night. And that's probably the biggest complaint that a lot of women have, is they'll wake up and they'll feel very warm, flushed, sweaty, they've got to get up, they can't get back to sleep. So thus, sleep disturbances, thus what we call that brain fog. And I want to emphasize too, this can happen not just in perimenopausal women. A lot of times younger women who are having very normal menstrual cycles will often notice these same symptoms just prior to their period starting. Some other things you'll see is the hair gets thinner, the skin. So again, think back, all of you probably had an experience with real elderly patients either in the nursing home or the hospital. You know, you'll notice those little ladies or gentlemen too. Their skin is real thin, they bruise easily. You've got to be real careful peeling tape off of them because it'll literally take the top layer off. The skin thins and they start losing that layer of sub-Q fat. As well, they may notice more changes in their vision. That goes with age. You know, a lot of people get to mid-age and they start needing bifocals, but then, you know, later in life, a lot of women will have problems with dry eye. You've probably seen commercials for Restasis. That's one of the prescriptions. Mood swings can be more prominent because probably the hormonal shifts, but also the lack of sleep can certainly contribute to it, as well as certain medications. And I'll try to highlight those as we go throughout this. Memory problems, and there's been a lot of research looking at, you know, memory problems, dementia, will hormone replacement help that, natural supplements, any number of things, looking at that.
Weight changes, it's no secret. Your metabolism slows as you age. And so you have two choices. You either eat less or move more, or possibly both. And so for many reasons, exercise is very beneficial. And I always tell everybody, by the time you're done with this class, you'll probably have heard me say any number of times, diet and exercise. They really are helpful for a lot of things. And when I say diet, I don't mean a diet where you restrict calories. What I mean is a healthy diet, and we'll talk about that. Vaginal changes, so same thing you're seeing going on with the skin and the hair. The vaginal tissues get thinner and drier. And not only can that cause problems with sexual activity and relationships, but same thing that's going on with the vaginal area also affects the bladder. And so a lot of times older women are very prone to frequent UTIs. And again, this is not really a lecture on geriatrics, but oftentimes you'll see in very elderly women that they've got recurrent UTIs or UTIs that aren't being treated, it can actually cause periods of confusion. So it's something just to, you know, you really kind of need to put, like I say, put all the pieces of the puzzle together. As a result of all the changes, you know, hormonally and, you know, intercourse can become more painful. A lot of women just aren't too excited about having sex anymore. We'll talk about that too. But really, so this is my little joke. Think puberty in reverse, you know. Think back to when you were, I don't know, 10, 12, 14, you're going into puberty. You know, a lot of days you didn't know what your body was going to do, what was going to happen next. Well, it's kind of the same thing. And by the way, I've been asked this before. I am a certified menopause educator. That was one of my many certifications I could just add on by yet another exam. But I've been asked, is there such a thing as manopause in men? And yes, there is. It just occurs a little bit later. They also will experience a lot of the same issues. It's just not talked about as much. So I think it's important to remember that. This really isn't just a woman's issue. Okay, so as I said, hot flashes occur in probably about 75% of all women. Hot flashes can occur because of other issues, though, too. Again, medications, sometimes endocrine tumors, you know, a drop in blood sugar can cause hot flashes. So it isn't always just, oh, you're menopausal, but it is something that we associate strongly. Really what it's related to, so I'll read this. I always think I'm going to change this, these lovely tulips. They're really nice to look at, but they're probably hard to read. But it's basically what causes hot flashes is there's decreasing levels of FSH, so follicle stimulating hormone, secreted by the anterior pituitary on day 3 of a menstrual cycle. That's in younger women, that's the hormone that drives the start of the whole cycle. Yes?
Do you say decreasing FSH?
Yes, yeah. Like, because
your slide says increasing estrogen and increasing.
I'm sorry. Yes. So it's decreasing estrogen, increasing FSH. Thank you for clarifying that. See, I needed that. So, yeah, so your estrogen levels are declining, but your pituitary is saying, well, wait a minute, I got to get those ovaries working, so I'm going to crank out more FSH. So that's why the FSH level is rising. So it's trying to drive the ovary, it's trying to stimulate it. And so technically, or kind of broadly, if you ever see someone having an FSH level drawn, which it's not usually done to prove menopause, but sometimes for infertility patients, usually if it's around 20 or greater, that's too high for a successful pregnancy or conception to occur. So that's kind of the rough cutoff. remember with labs, no matter what the lab test is, every lab, wherever it is, you know, they calibrate their machines and they kind of all are a little bit different. So that's why whenever you look at lab work, you always want to see what are the norms that that specific lab gives you. But what's happening is your estrogen's going down, your FSH is going up, it's trying to stimulate the ovaries. They're not responding. And as a result of that, the thermoregulation center in the hypothalamus is off, is out of balance. It's not sure what's going on. And so what happens then is that the mechanism that causes arterioles to expand and contract becomes unsteady. So again, it's like those little spasms, and that's why women will often say they can be standing somewhere and all of a sudden they just get this flush of heat, or they feel like they're hot, or literally they sometimes will start perspiring. That's very normal to see that. So it just is a very unstable process. Okay, this is like trying to play a video game, you know? I'm not very good at video games. All right, just as a reminder, so estrogen and progesterone, very important hormones for women. Actually, they also are in men in much smaller amounts, but estrogen and progesterone. So again, estrogen in young girls in puberty, approaching puberty, estrogen is responsible for that long bone closure after puberty. And it's also responsible to regulate, we tend to think of it as the first half of the menstrual cycle. Okay. Progesterone regulates the latter half of the menstrual cycle. And again, when I talk about infertility, sometimes in infertility patients, you'll see them having their progesterone level measured when they're trying to get pregnant to see if it's adequate to support a pregnancy, because progesterone also helps build up the lining of the uterus. So again, in infertility patients, if they don't have adequate progesterone production, they may be ovulating and conceiving, but they're never able to retain that pregnancy if their progesterone level's too low. So it's really important. You kind of think of it as, you know, you put fertilizer in a garden to make, you know, you get better production. Well, that's what kind of progesterone is. It's the fertilizer of the reproductive system, I guess. All right. And then in both men and women, testosterone is responsible for libido. Okay. Women to a lesser extent, but it also serves that purpose. Okay, so some other changes. You'll see a decrease in bone density. This is really an important one to remember because, again, as I said, you're probably going to see about half your patient population roughly is going to be over the age of 50. That decrease in bone density can lead to osteopenia and osteoporosis, which we're going to talk about later. But it's the reason why, so if you work in the ER, in the future, you're probably going to see a lot of elderly, or not elderly, older adults coming in who suffered a slip, a fall, and get, you know, a major fracture. So it speaks to why we really want to be talking about safety in the home, and that's why everywhere you go, if you work with older populations, that's often what's suggested is, you know, do a home assessment and make sure that, you know, there's no tripping hazards. Actually, you know what the number one cause of falls is in, like, older women? Any guesses?
The dogs?
Yeah. They've been walking those little dogs and they trip over them. So, anyway, I almost stepped on one over the weekend. I was in a store and I literally did not realize this woman had a dog. It was like a large, I apologize if I offend anyone, but really it was about the size of a large rat. I almost stepped on her dog in the store and I thought, oh. Anyway. Okay, the other thing to remember is it has effects on the heart and blood vessels. Now, women tend to have heart problems. They're catching up with men. It just occurs later, right? But something to remember is women between the ages of 45 and 65, so really that's young, they already have some disease going on. And I would guess as we continue to look at that, we're probably going to see that going down into younger adults. So, as I said, the skin is less elastic. They may lose some pigment. So sometimes you'll see older adults, now I'm going to speak mostly women because women tend to color their hair a lot, but sometimes you'll see these older women that, you know, they want to keep their hair color, and they color it too dark and then they really look pale. You ever seen those ladies? Yeah. So they've actually lost some of their skin tone. As I said, GU tract, so, you know, vaginal dryness. Dyspareunia is painful intercourse. Incontinence can become an issue. And so sometimes what you'll see as a treatment for incontinence is not a drug specifically for that, but maybe some hormone replacement. And as I said, frequent UTIs can be a problem. You know, in men, speaking of, since I'm trying to, you know, address menopause along with men, it should be womanopause and manopause, I guess. But anyway, in men, they start experiencing urinary problems, but it's usually due to an enlarged prostate. So, you know, as I said, in the brain, there can be, you know, that sleep deprivation, memory issues, that brain fog that goes on. So, and again, you can't always assume it's because of hormones. I think sometimes now our society, you know, we've become a very much 24/7 society and there's a lot of, to deal with every day. So, okay, let's see if we can, yes, okay, here we go. So this is my little cartoon. He's saying, many women report sleep disturbances associated with the postmenopausal period, and he's saying to her, are we going to have sex or not? So probably as you get older, you'll appreciate the humor of this joke. Okay, so can you read what that says? That is Señor Viagra. He was down in Mexico. And let's see, I think it's, oh, mucho caliente. He's very hot. So I had to take a picture of this, and my poor son was with us, and my kids are used to it. But I will tell you that I do remember when Viagra came on the market, and it was kind of considered this wonder drug, but the problem was suddenly all these men were coming home with a script for Viagra, saying, look what I got. And her wife was saying, oh, yeah. So it can cause real problems. And sometimes what you'll see is sometimes couples are going into marriage counseling late in life over this issue. But, yeah, Señor Viagra, by the way, notice you could buy about every drug. That was a pharmacy in Mexico. And, by the way, it was interesting because of course, my husband and I are the same age, and we had, you know, guys hollering at my husband all the time, Señor, come over, I sell you some Viagra. So, anyway, when you're with your young adult son, I don't think he wants to be a part of that. Anyway, oh, and then this was another one I saw also in Mexico. This is the ladies' restroom. I thought that was pretty good to demonstrate the problems with incontinence, so. Alright. Okay, so HRT is hormone replacement therapy. This could be like a week-long seminar. Back in the 1960s, a cardiologist wrote a book, and his theory was that if we just gave every woman estrogen for the rest of her life, it was like the fountain of youth. And I can tell you, when I started working in OBGYN in an office, everybody got scripts for hormone replacement therapy. I mean, it was just standard. It was like you either came in and got birth control pills or hormones. I mean, everybody left with something that day. Lots of studies gone into this. We now know that hormone replacement therapy doesn't decrease heart attacks. In fact, it may increase the rate. The jury's still out about whether it helps with dementia, but right now, probably not. The main reason to use HRT, hormone replacement therapy, is for relief of hot flashes. So it is appropriate. There are some women who should never, and I want to emphasize this, never take hormone replacement therapy. Most likely, women who've had breast cancer or other gynecological cancers aren't usually given HRT. Women with heart disease, women over the age of 35 who smoke. So it's just important to understand that hormones are not bad drugs, but they're powerful and they should be prescribed to the right populations. The current recommendation is it's okay to give HRT for relief of hot flashes, lowest dose possible, for shortest time possible, and that shortest time is probably 2 years. And I don't even try to keep up anymore. There are so many different preparations and so many ways they can be given. Women can take a pill, they can use a patch, they can use a vaginal cream. There's IUDs, progestacert IUDs sometimes are used. Any number of mechanisms of delivery and different schedules. Sometimes you'll see women coming in, so I told you that you may see a younger woman who has a hysterectomy, but she still has her ovaries. And you might be seeing her for something else and you happen to notice, oh, why is she taking birth control pills? Sometimes it's for hormone regulation. So I've always said birth control pills really, they've kind of been given the wrong name. Yes, contraception is one of their functions, but they also function as hormone replacement. So sometimes women are approaching that perimenopausal time, having a really tough time. You can put them on a low-dose birth control pill and it sort of regulates everything out for them. So. Also, there was a reduction in risk of colon cancers in women that take hormone replacement. So if they've got a strong family history, that certainly isn't the main reason to put them on it, but it's a side benefit. But as I said, if someone comes in and they've got a history of breast cancer, they should not be taking hormones. There's a reduced risk of bone fracture, and we used to say that that was a primary treatment for bones, thinning bones. We don't anymore. There's better drugs, and we'll talk about those. But really, as I said, relief of hot flashes or vaginal dryness, and again, that lowest dose for the shortest time. By the way, any medicine, so again, we talk about hormone replacement. A lot of times it can be given just as a vag cream. They don't get the systemic effects. And so for some women, that's a more desirable delivery system. Same thing with certain forms of contraception. The NuvaRing, it bypasses the liver, and they won't get those systemic effects from it. Okay, yeah, I just kind of talked about this a little bit already. So you can give women oral, vaginal, dermal, many forms of either estrogen or progesterone. Once in a while, you'll see women that take estrogen along with a low dose of testosterone to boost their libido, that sense of well-being. There's controversy. Some women are comfortable taking it. Given the risk, there may be maybe a higher risk of certain cancers. So you don't see a lot of women taking testosterone. A Mirena IUD because it secretes progesterone. Works really well for some women. The SSRIs or the SNRIs, so the drug, you know, any of the drugs like what? Oh, Paxil, Prozac, Wellbutrin, any number of those are good. Lexapro are all can be helpful for women, but it's not always the first line drug. In fact, a number of years ago, one of the drug companies got really smart and said, let's get a new indication for our drug, and I think it was Paxil. It was either Prozac or Paxil. They went to the FDA and got another indication for premenstrual syndrome. They put a different name on it, marketed it for that, and then they got to extend their drug patent out. So, interesting marketing. But as I said, you know, we've talked about this. Yes, Laura.
Oh, well, just specifically for the SSRIs, are they just drugs marketed to relieving any specific menopause like symptom? Or because I feel like recently I was reading that SSRIs can actually decrease like libido.
Yeah, well, that's the downside. See, that for a lot of people, a lot of adults of any age, that's why they don't like taking SSRIs, because it kills their libido.
Yeah.
But sometimes for some women, the hot flashes are so bad that this can be a viable alternative if they can't take hormone replacement therapy. So it's like really any medication, you've always got to talk about what are the risks, what are the side effects, what are you willing to live with as a patient? So, but I just want to emphasize, any woman that's ever had a history of blood clots, we talked about this a little bit throughout the semester, should never take hormone replacement therapy. It's just like pregnancy, you know. Pregnancy puts women at higher risk for blood clots because it's a hyper hormonal state. So even though she's in menopause, we don't want to give her more hormones if she has a history of blood clots. As I said, certain cancers, usually breast or uterine, or strokes or heart disease. We need to look at other alternatives. Now, you will see patients who will say, you know what, my doctor told me all of that, but you know what, I'm willing to put up with the risk because this has increased the quality of my life. So as long as patients understand, I think that's the important thing. Okay, let's see here if I can get to, oh, there we go. So another little joke. Life was moving along at a nice steady pace, and then I hit middle age and my life hot flashed before my eyes. So I have a joke on my refrigerator in my office. It's some woman, she's holding a cocktail and her hair's on fire, and it says, I discovered alcohol and hot flashes don't mix. Okay, so let's just talk briefly about this. How are we doing on time? Okay. So, you know, we just had October. It was Breast Cancer Awareness Month. But really, it's something we need to be aware of all the time. Breast cancer is occurring in more and more younger women. I just talked to one of our former grads who's now working at Frontier Oncology Center, and she said, I'm surprised by the number of women I'm seeing in their 30s with breast cancer. So this is not just an older woman's disease. You all have probably heard the statistic that, you know, 1 in 8 women will experience breast cancer in their lifetime. That has not changed. But I want to emphasize the number one cause of cancer death in women is actually lung cancer. It's not breast cancer. So I think it's really important to help put that in perspective for patients. The recommendations are still women should start getting mammograms yearly at age 40. Certainly if they have other risk factors, family history, maybe younger. St. V's has the bus, you know, you've probably seen it around town, the big pink bus that they go out and do mobile mammograms. You know, there was discussion a number of years back, should women still be doing self-breast exams? Are they effective? personally, I say yes, because anytime, I think all adults, men, women of all ages, should be aware of their body and its normal function when something abnormal is going on. And I really believe this more and more, because I think that in medical care, a lot of times things get lost in the shuffle, and so patients really need to be, in a sense, their own advocate. We know more and more that the number one preventer of breast cancer is, here we go, diet and exercise, keeping a healthy weight. And so more and more you're seeing that. I belong to the YMCA here, and they are partnering and have been with St. Bee's for quite a long time, and they offer a lot of classes aimed at specific groups of patients. One of them happens to be the Live Strong program. That's actually for cancer survivors, but they've got a class for pre-diabetes, any number of things. So, you know, I still believe nurses need to be the little, not little, we are big. We are a big group. And we really do need to promote healthy living. So right now, the recommendation is still the same. Try to keep daily dietary fat under about 30% of your diet. And really, that's what I said earlier. A diet is not calorie deprivation. It's helping people figure out what are healthy foods to eat. So again, those edges of the grocery store, where the produce is, and the meats, and the lower fat items. All the prepared stuff in the center, that's where we all need to steer away from. Alcohol in moderation or eliminated altogether. So alcohol in moderation, that works out to 2 drinks a day for men, but just 1 for women. And it does not mean, I've been asked this before, it does not mean you can go all week and then have 7 on Friday night. Doesn't work. Interestingly, this is something that's getting more attention, because I don't know if all of you've noticed, but drinking and especially wine consumption is really being marketed towards women. So here's your homework assignment. No, you should not all go out and buy a bottle of wine unless you're 21, then you do what you want. But next time you're in the grocery store, take a look at the wine bottle labels and look at how many of them appeal to women. And that is the reason why. And interestingly, a lot of retail has gotten on this trend. Younger adults are not going and shopping in malls and in stores. You know, everybody's Amazoning. You know, today's Cyber Monday. Yeah. So a lot of retailers now, there's one in town I know of. In fact, I've been invited to one very soon. They call it a girls' night out, and they serve you wine and hors d'oeuvres. And, of course, they'd like to have you have plenty of it so then you'll shop more in their store. So I don't want to imply whether I agree, disagree, whether I think this is bad or good. I just think it's important to help patients understand. You can enjoy life, but, you know, you don't want to overdo. And we've always known that. There are specific groups that are at higher risk for breast cancer. Certainly any woman whose mother had breast cancer is at probably about 20% higher risk. Certain genetic mutations. I talked about the BRCA mutation. Since I created this lecture, even in just the last year, there's been about, I think, 13 or 17 more genetic mutations that have been discovered. That's an area that's going to probably, it's exploding, and I think in your lifetime in healthcare, it's going to continue to explode. And it's, again, how much do you want to know, and what are you going to do with the information? You can now get Ancestry DNA test. It's on sale, Cyber Monday. It's $49. By the way, I did mine, so, and it was very interesting, but mine wasn't $49. But it doesn't give you your health. That's those direct-to-marketing, like 23andMe, some of those. But again, the problem is you may get a result back, and if you don't meet with a professional
who can explain it. It may or may not mean what it should, or it may mean too much to you. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is, as nurses, if you see someone who might be at risk for a genetic predisposition, have them see a genetics counselor. We have one at both hospital systems here, and they are invaluable in helping families navigate. I think a lot of people think, why should I have this done? I can't do anything about it. Well, no, we can't change our genetics, but we certainly can change some of our health strategies to maybe head off, because I always say we're not totally our genes. They're just a part of us. So I think it's important to identify who those folks at risk are. All right. People are nodding off. I can see it. It's either getting warm in here or I'm boring you. So I'm going to make you get up and walk around for 5 minutes and come back, and we'll carry on. And I'll try to get the computer working.
Thursday,
because
I'm in PE.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, let's look at Friday then. Let me just throw some times down on Fridays. Let's see.
I know. It's frustrating. Yes.
So that would be the 7th.
So we have
or
house.
What?
Yeah, we have.
Oh, you
Thursday
do.
That's why
okay,
we can't do Thursday.
So Wednesday. Well, I can add some to Wednesday the 5th.
I don't think so.
I think we do.
Okay, so let me just add some times on. So let's see. So let's say 2:10. I try to stick to my schedule, but sometimes I get off track. Oops. There.
Okay. Oh, it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, I'm never sure, because I know with pals and everything, your schedule gets...
Right, yeah.
Your
yeah.
schedules are crazy.
Yeah,
so,
all over.
Right.
So that's 2:30 on
Wednesday. Yeah. And I'll hang this up on my door.
I would say.
Get rolling and
so I just want to talk about this briefly just because again you're seeing so many more women who are surviving breast cancer. When I was a nursing student again a few years back, a few decades, it was pretty much a death sentence. It's not true anymore, but again, as I said, you're seeing younger women who are living longer, so odds are you're going to be seeing these patients. Surgery, it can be anything from a lumpectomy, a mastectomy, total reconstruction. Just be aware of that. Associated with it, anytime a patient has had a lumpectomy or mastectomy, she may have had her lymph nodes removed in her affected arm, and those patients can be at high risk for infections in that arm. As you remember, maybe way back from your sophomore year, you know what, like 5 years ago? I'm teasing you guys. You shouldn't take their blood pressure or draw blood in that arm, all right? Oftentimes patients will just do lumpectomy radiation. They actually can get the same rates of cure as they can with a mastectomy in some types of cancer. There's about 17 different types of breast cancer that we know of at this point. So that's why it's always important, and this is true for all oncology patients. One person's treatment may be totally different. You know, back in the 60s, there was this big thing, they were going to find the cure for cancer. Well, you all know there's, you know, cancer's not just one disease. A multitude of things. So chemotherapy, and what's exciting about all the research going on right now is chemotherapy is probably going to go away for breast cancer in the future, and we're going to be looking at immune therapy. And that's the cool thing about the CRISPR technology, when it's used appropriately, is it's really helped with the development of immunotherapies, not just for breast cancer, but all cancers.
Teresa, so, how is CRISPR spelled?
It's all capital letters. Uh-huh. It's CRISPR.
Thank you.
And honestly, I've heard a talk on it, and it was very fascinating, but I couldn't give that talk again. I know that's what I remember about it. So, a lot of times you'll see patients on hormonal therapy. Now, remember I said we don't give them hormones, right? What we're really giving them is an aromatase inhibitor. So that's not really a hormone. It's a drug that shuts off hormone production. So those are drugs known as AIs, not artificial intelligence, but aromatase inhibitors. I don't expect you all to remember that, but you might hear that term. Tamoxifen is probably a drug a lot of you've heard of. It's in a similar class. But the thing to remember, a lot of times these women, they're dealing with a lot of long-term effects, and therefore there's some survivor issues. And in fact, now a lot of oncology programs actually have nurse navigators for cancer survivors. So you sometimes will see, you know, breast cancer navigator, head and neck cancer navigators. They've now recognized that that's a whole group in itself, cancer survivors. I don't remember how many millions there are in the United States. By the way, Yellowstone County happens to be one of the highest grossing counties for Relay for Life, the amount of money they raise every year. So I think that's pretty cool. But certainly women, again, if you're taking care of them, remind them, have you had your mammogram? Are you going in and getting screened? I just heard of someone who I'm not directly related to her, but I always call them shirt tail relatives, you know, by marriage. Just found out she has stage 4 breast cancer. And I don't know any details, but I just think, how do we get to that point? You know, what got missed along the way? But the thing to remember is this is now looked at as a chronic illness, like diabetes or high blood pressure. So it's important to remember that and take care of these patients.
So I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So if you have to have a mastectomy, this is kind of off topic, but will insurance help cover the reconstruction for that, or are you just going to screw it?
No, that is a good question. There's actually a law that Congress mandated that they must cover reconstruction. So, yeah, if you ever, you know, you guys will find as you get out in your careers, you're going to hear a lot about medical billing issues, and that's another one of my soapbox issues because I've had my own struggles with it. But it's really screwed up. I don't know how else to say it. And sometimes patients will get told that it's been denied. No. It is a law. It is federal law that they have to. Now, again, I don't want to get off on politics, but there's a lot of discussion about changing healthcare and excluding people with pre-existing conditions. Well, here we go. Here's a pre-existing condition. So that's why I say I don't ever tell people how to vote, but I hope as nurses going into the future, that's part of being an advocate for your patient and being aware of what's going on. So, anyway, but yeah, they do have to cover it. So, and a lot of times insurance will kind of kick its feet about covering genetic testing, and so that's why it's often good to have those patients see a genetics counselor. Then they can write a letter stating this is why this person should be screened. You can now have your entire human genome sequenced for $1,000. So the price is coming down. The BRCA testing, when it was first started about 10, 15 years ago, well, no, it's been over 10 years ago, more like 15 or 20 years ago, for a number of years, a certain lab held the patent on that testing, and it was about $4,000 to be tested just for one genetic mutation, and they weren't playing nice, they weren't sharing their data with any other researchers. That went to the Supreme Court a few years ago and was overturned, and as a result, the price of testing has come way down. So that was a good thing. Okay. All right. Again, this is just some facts and figures.
I don't expect you all to memorize this. I am not going to make a test question out of this. It's more to help you appreciate the other types of reproductive tract cancers that women see or deal with. Ovarian, thing to remember is it's very difficult to detect it early, and that's why it's a harder to treat cancer, because the symptoms are vague. Abdominal bloating, maybe some urinary frequency, vague abdominal pain. So it may not always be picked up in the earlier stages. That's why it's harder to treat. Again, research is looking at, can they develop a blood test for specific markers? But again, that's why we want to identify families. I didn't spend a lot of time on the BRCA mutation. It's associated with breast and ovarian cancers. And by the way, it's not just passed through women or just to women. Men can pass the BRCA mutation on to their sons and their daughters. It can also lead to male breast cancers. I should have really talked about that a moment ago. There's probably about 1,000 cases a year in the United States, but it does happen. It can be associated with maybe some prostate cancers. And in families with pancreatic cancer, it can be related to the BRCA mutation. So again, it goes back to just like in OB, when you start getting that health history, you know, that's why docs are always interested in, you know, what did your parents die of? What age? What was the diagnosis? Cervical cancer, everybody knows, I hope, it's associated with HPV. And again, it is spread through sexual activity. And that's why, you know, Gardasil, ideally, we would give it to both males and females. Again, a lot of politics got attached to that. But really, you know, from a scientific point of view, what it's doing is hopefully helping to prevent a cancer later in life. I think just a lot of parents struggle with, why should I give my 10 or 11-year-old child this immunization? Endometrial cancer is cancer of the lining of the uterus. It's one of the most common female cancers you'll see, and what it's usually associated with is women who've had a long history of irregular ovulation, irregular menstrual cycles. And by the way, women with a higher BMI in combination with those irregular cycles can be at higher risk. So again, sometimes you might see those are the patients that are sent off for ultrasound and more testing if they present with irregular menstrual bleeding. Oftentimes it's around the time of menopause when they start noticing symptoms. Vulvar cancer is not seen real often, but it's also associated with HPV. Vulvar, cervical, and anal cancers are all associated with HPV. And we're seeing higher rates of anal cancers. So it's not an easy topic. It's not something you want to bring up at like a cocktail party, but certainly in talking with patients, it's important to know. I know someone who was diagnosed with an anal cancer, thought they had a hemorrhoid, and it turned out to be a tumor. So again, you know, as a nurse, you want to get a good history on your patients. Vaginal and fallopian tube cancers are rare. However, the later research now, they're thinking that actually ovarian cancers start in the fallopian tubes. So there's currently a research study going on. Women who are from families with higher rates of ovarian cancers, instead of doing prophylactic oophorectomies, which are not pleasant because those are surgeries where, you know, especially in younger women, if they're premenopausal and they go in to have their ovaries removed, they're going to feel like themselves going into surgery, and they're going to wake up and they're in instant menopause, full bore. And it's difficult. So there's a research study going on that's looking at maybe we can just remove fallopian tubes rather than remove ovaries. So we'll see where that leads to. Okay. Let's talk about bones. And I always forget. I have a little bone model in my office that the hormone salesman gave me years ago. But basically, osteoporosis is diagnosed by doing a bone density scan. Now, that's different than bone scans. You'll hear about cancer patients having a bone scan. That's looking at, do they have cancer in their bones? But a bone density scan or study is looking at how strong is the bone structure. Because think about, you know, if you are out in the woods and you pick up a fairly young branch and you try to break it in half, it doesn't break easily. It might bend a lot because it's young, it's healthy. Same size branch, if it's old and dead and been laying there for a while and you go to snap it, it just snaps in half. And so that's a good way to remember osteoporosis. It's that loss of that density of the bone. And it results from decreasing levels of estrogen after menopause. And so that's why for some women, taking estrogen after menopause will actually help their bone density. We don't prescribe estrogen for that purpose, however, but it can be a good side effect of the drug. And basically, estrogen is needed for the conversion of vitamin D into calcitonin in the gut. And that's the role estrogen plays in bone health. About half of all American women over the age of 50 have some degree of bone loss. Now there's normal bone mass, and then there's what we call osteopenia, that's more thinning bones, and then there's full-on osteoporosis. So ideally you catch those women with osteopenia and hopefully get them to make some changes. Again, exercise is a biggie. Diet, maybe not. But a lot of times getting them in an impact-based exercise, so walking, something that is impact-based. But weightlifting is also good. Cardiovascular exercise is important too, but that's probably not going to help their bone mass. It's going to be good for the rest of them. But they actually, that's why all these little old ladies have those dogs that they're walking and hopefully not tripping over. So, as I said, a lot of times if you can't totally prevent it, perhaps you can minimize it with some lifestyle modifications. I always think of nurses, our job is, I'm sure every one of you has had a healthcare provider at some point who said, well, you need to decrease your stress. And you're sitting there thinking, really? What am I supposed to do? So I always think, nurses, our job is not to fix everything, nor can we, although I think we do. I love that t-shirt that says, I'm a nurse, what's your superpower? But I think a lot of times our job is to strategize with our patients. So again, if you get someone who says, I can't exercise, I can't afford to join a gym, or I don't have an hour a day, or I don't have, well, you know what, can you walk for 10 minutes three times a day? Some of those simple strategies, walking, parking farther away, taking the stairs instead of the elevator, trying to help people incorporate some of that into their life. I think I said this to you a few weeks back, anybody know what I always say? I bought a piece of exercise equipment, cheapest I ever bought. You know what it was? My dog. Yep, I adopted a rescue dog. Back then it was $25. Now it's about $150, but that's still cheaper than a treadmill or some of those other pieces of equipment. In fact, we sold all ours because they were like really elaborate, dusty clothes racks, and we joined the gym instead. So. But some other facts to remember. So peak bone mass is reached by the age of 30. So everybody in here who is under 30, go out and walk for 5 minutes today. majority of bone mass is built in childhood. So now think about over in peds. What have you seen kids eating and drinking and doing? Yeah, and this is why we're facing more of this. Childhood has changed. It is video games. It is sugary drinks. It's your mom picks you up every day after school. You know, you don't see kids walking so much anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of work for all of us as healthcare educators, because really, hopefully this is a preventable condition. Now, in people who are of white Northern European descent, we tend to have more problems with osteoporosis. So, but also very petite women, oftentimes you'll see very petite Asian women or really very, very petite women, they can be at higher risk for osteoporosis. I always say, think about those of you who've been around a grandmother throughout your life. You know, if you see them stooped over and walking, that is not normal with aging. That is a sign that they have some bone loss. And by the way, osteoporosis, again, occurs equally, or not equally. It occurs in both men and women, just lower rates in men, but you do see it. As I said, yeah, look for that loss of height or that stooping posture. That's, you know, probably a lot of you, if you ask, again, if you've got grandmothers or elderly female relatives, you know, you get a chance, you know, in conversation. So how many inches have you lost in your lifetime? They probably don't want to tell you that, but you often see that in adults of all ages. As I said, it's a bone density scan. It's known as a DEXA scan, and that's different than a bone scan for cancer. And that will predict or give you an indication of what's going on. I put the norms there just because, again, I don't expect you to memorize this, but if you get asked by, you know, your grandma or maybe your mom's, it's reported out as a T score. And they have three categories. They'll say it's above minus one. That's great. Your bones are in great health. If you're in this area of this minus one to minus 2.5, that's osteopenia. Those are the people we like to identify and try to up their exercise. Now, I will tell you, for years, we had, when I worked in women's health, oh man, we had women taking massive amounts of calcium supplements. You know, if a little was good, a whole lot more was better. There was the calcium chocolate chews. I mean, women were eating those all day long. We now know that, well, that's maybe not such a good thing. It can lead to calcification in other parts of the body, a great arch of the aorta, some women, kidney stones, things like that. So again, it goes back to get that diet history and find out, is your patient getting enough dietary calcium? A lot of adults are not. Then it's appropriate to recommend a specific amount of calcium supplementation. If they're below that minus 2.5, they have osteoporosis, and they definitely need to be treated. And about one out of two women has symptoms that are severe enough to make them fracture prone. So if you're going to be working in the ER in the future, get the cast materials out because they show up. And interestingly, so I was reading about hip fractures. This was a few years back. And of all the adults that have a hip fracture in the first year, or of all the adults who have a hip fracture, by the end of about 1 year, anywhere from about 12 to 20% of them will die. Not from the fracture itself, but probably from another complication, either a blood clot, pneumonia, decreased mobility, okay? And then of the rest of those that don't die in the first year, about half of them end up in an assisted living facility. So we need to change that trend because, again, there's a whole lot of people, the baby boomers, and there's not enough assisted living, and there's not going to be enough people to take care of all of them if they all go to assisted living. So it really is, not just from a health standpoint, but from an economic standpoint, you want to keep all of them out of the assisted living and using up all the Medicare money. So it's cheaper to have them go to the gym. All right, so these are all the risk factors. You should be aware of these. I can tell you, this will be on the test. But I just like to put it all there because you can see how many people. Number one is female, postmenopausal, a fracture after the age of 50, family history, anyone with, like I said, that petite, small frame, any woman that's been estrogen deficient for any number of reasons in her lifetime, or had a history of amenorrhea. So think of athletes, Olympic athletes. Men who have a lifetime history of a low testosterone level for whatever reason. As I said, Caucasians, Asians tend to have higher rates. Low calcium intake over your lifetime can certainly lead to it. Milk is not the only way to get your calcium. So what are some dietary sources of calcium besides dairy?
Broccoli.
Yeah, dark green. Any others? I don't eat this, nor do I know a lot of people that do, but actually the canned salmon with the bones in it is very high in calcium. Yeah, yeah. But dark green leafy vegetables, certainly dairy. But, for instance, orange juices sometimes are supplemented with extra calcium. Certain, you know, breakfast cereals. So, you know, again, helping patients figure out if they don't want to take calcium, where can they get it in their diet? Certain drug classes, corticosteroids, anticonvulsants, can put people at higher risk for osteoporosis. So you want to look at, you know, have they been on long-term use? Vitamin D deficiency. All of you in here should have had your vitamin D level checked. If you haven't, I would recommend that you do. Many of us live in the north and we don't see enough sun all year round. Again, they're looking at Northern European descent. Maybe it's a genetic thing that's passed down. But certainly everyone should get their vitamin D level checked. Inactive lifestyle. Women with anorexia nervosa, which is a psychiatric condition where women literally starve themselves. And so they can have it. Excessive use of alcohol. So again, another reason to not go too wild. Smoking, another good reason to give our patients. And then RA, rheumatoid arthritis, MS, multiple sclerosis, or hemophiliacs. Those three groups can also be at higher risk. So you can see it's a broad category of patients that might struggle with bone loss. So I've talked a little bit about all this. Diet and exercise, when I say all three types, so aerobic, you know, like running, cycling, that impact exercise, walking, running. A lot of older adults don't run because of joint issues, but walking is very beneficial. And then weight lifting. All three of those are essential. Estrogen will preserve bone density and reduce fractures, but it should not be the primary therapy. So bisphosphonates have come along, and they're great drugs to help with osteoporosis. I put the names of three of them. There's more now, Fosamax, Actinil, Boniva. There's now one called Reclast. The thing about Reclast, it's a great drug. You go in and it's a once a year IV infusion. It takes 15 minutes and you're good for a year. Those drugs will help prevent bone loss or reduce bone loss, and they prevent fractures in the spine, the hip, and the wrist. Those are the three big areas where you often see those. So they're good drugs. However, the downside to bisphosphonates, the oral ones, can cause patients a lot of esophageal problems. And you'll see when you give those that it actually says if the patient can't sit upright for 30 minutes after the administration of the pill, they really are not a good candidate to take the drug. But as I said, there's now the once a year IV infusion. SERMs are, I'll tell you what they are. You do not have to remember this. Selective estrogen receptor modulator drugs. That's why we call them SERMs. What that means is those drugs will build bone mass, but they don't affect estrogen sensitive tissues such as breasts and the reproductive tissue. So for women who are, again, most women at higher risk for cancers of those organs, this could be a good drug for them. And in fact, in some women, you will see a SERM prescribed to them as a preventative therapy for breast cancers. Not all women, but certain populations. Calcitonin, you don't see too much. It's a nasal spray. You don't see it used. The only drug out there that will actually stimulate new bone growth is a drug called Forteo, and it's pure parathyroid hormone. Okay. Now, the reason it's not prescribed very often is it's a daily injection, it's a daily injection, IM injection, that patients take for 2 years. I mean, really, who wants to get up and have an IM injection every day? I realize diabetics do, but, you know, there's just a bit of difference. It's also incredibly expensive, so you don't see it. You may never see it. Those are still the current recommendations for calcium and vitamin D. People are taking a whole lot more vitamin D than that, and providers are also recommending higher doses of vitamin D, but those are kind of the official ones. As I said, sources of dietary calcium. Stop smoking. You know, we just can give patients so many reasons. Another reason, and this is a bit of vanity, but you can tell adults who smoked and they get to about age 50, and I can about pick out who smoked and who didn't. They're going to look a lot more wrinkled. So that's a good thing to tell your patients. And again, just being aware of alcohol and caffeine intake, because those can both interfere with bone, the buildup of bone. Sorry. All right, cardiovascular disease. Big issue in women. About half of all the women that die in a given year, about half of it is from either MIs or strokes. Cancer's probably going to overtake that pretty soon, but right now it's still true. Again, I said this earlier, breast cancer is not a death sentence. 1 in 2 women will die from heart disease, while only about 1 in 30 women will die from breast cancer. But the interesting thing is, when I was an office nurse, if I had to call up a patient and say, your mammogram looked abnormal, they want you to come in for a second look, or your pap smear came back abnormal, you need to come back, I can guarantee you I would have a woman in tears on the other end of the phone, or absolutely panicked, or wanting to know, could they come today? Now, I could call up 5 other women and say, your cholesterol is elevated, your doctor would like you to decrease the, you know, and that, you know what response I get? Okay. But, you know, it just shows there's a lot of health education that still needs to be done. About half of all Americans over the age of 55 have high blood pressure. What's interesting is rates of high blood pressure in younger adults is increasing, but we're not catching it as early because most younger adults don't go to the doctor as often. And again, internal med docs are now seeing children, you know, young adolescents with high cholesterol and high blood pressure. collaborate with internal medicine because they're not sure how to treat that because it's a newer phenomenon. So, and again, diabetes is increasing, and we know that that can have effects on heart disease and high blood pressure. So I'm going to try to, this is like a real challenge today. Okay. So again, this is just talking a little bit about youth. You know, heart disease, osteoporosis, really the roots of those diseases, if you go way back, oftentimes you start to see where the behaviors in young adults can lead to this. So just some things, this is old information. You know, government, school districts, a lot of times when they want to cut funding, what do? They get rid of PE or recess, when really we probably should keep PE and recess, and probably kids would do better academically. You know, there's a whole discussion about that with ADHD and ADD. You know, oftentimes those kids act out, and so what does the teacher do? Makes them sit in the class during recess when really that kid probably needs to go out and run off some steam. Interestingly, children who are overweight at age 2, and again, this goes back to infants of diabetic mothers. We know that they're more likely to be overweight as young children, and those young children are 5 times more likely to be overweight as adults. So again, it really goes back to, that's why we like that whole thing with preconception. We want to give our moms good advice about diet and exercise, and hopefully head some of these problems off. I've had read an article that they interviewed all these athletic trainers about why people canceled their appointments with them. And the article really was kind of funny, like, well, the escalator was broken, so I couldn't get up to the gym. It was like a gym in a city, you know. Well, take the stairs, you know, that could be part of your training. Or, oh, the weather was bad. I can sort of see that. But think about real life things, you know, work commitments, school commitments, family. You know, aren't we all kind of victims to the screen? So there's a lot of, sometimes getting exercises it's something you've got to schedule for yourself. And I think it's important to help patients understand it's not an extravagance. It's an important part of taking care of this whole package of who you are. So again, just some basics. You guys know all this, you know, getting people to stop smoking. In Montana, we have the Montana Quit Line. Patients can be given that information. They can call up. They can get a lot of support to help them stop smoking. Heart healthy diet, you know, Mediterranean diet, we talk a lot about it. Lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, use of healthy fats like olive oil, eating nuts. A Mediterranean diet tends to be heavy in like cooked tomato-based foods. And those are very good at, you know, heart health and many other things. It's actually good for your prostate. So, guys, as you get older, eat lots of tomato sauce. It'll be good for your prostate. Yeah, you got that. That's your tip of the day. People with a sedentary lifestyle, that's the most prevalent risk factor for heart disease. So, again, working with kids and families, you want to try to get them doing that. The effect of stress, you know, in the short term, it has its effects, but it also has long-term effects. They've actually looked at some changes in the lining of blood vessels of people who are chronically stressed. And this is just my own philosophy. It has been way back since I was a student, but I really believe nurses are holistic. We're prevention-focused, and so really, we're the ideal ones who should be doing this. I really do mean it. I feel like kind of, you know, silly, but I really believe we are ambassadors for health. And I hope all of us can continue to do that. That's why I hate to see so many, this is just my own thing, a lot of jobs are being replaced, nursing jobs, by non-nursing people. everybody who's 20 and older should have had a fasting lipid profile. So your cholesterol, your HDL, your LDL, and your triglycerides. You want to know what those are. Age 45, everybody should be screened for diabetes, and probably most everyone now has had a blood sugar before that. I listed the groups who can be at higher risk for that. Again, we know that women who have gestational diabetes are at higher risk for diabetes the rest of their life, and they should have a yearly blood sugar done. So again, those women you take care of postpartum, you need to let them know that. Metabolic syndrome, you probably talked about that last semester. It's that waist greater than 35 inches, elevated triglycerides, elevated fasting glucose, you know, HDLs, and a blood pressure. On here I have 130 over 85. Now, newest recs from internal medicine is that really everybody's blood pressure is going to be under 120. So if you haven't had your blood pressure checked in a while, grab a cuff up at the school and check it, see where you're at. I always think it'd be interesting, like, to check my class's blood pressure at the beginning of the semester and the end of the semester and see where it's at. Maybe I'll do that some year as a class project. I would make it anonymous. Okay, let's see here. Here we go. Come back. Where are we at? How are we doing for time? Okay, so again, nutrition, looking at those fats, so those trans fats, and that's why prepared foods are higher in trans fats, and those are the ones that cause all the problems. So that's why olive oils, nut oils are healthier. Canola oil, probably all of you are too young to remember Crisco. It was a big blue tin. Man, it made the best cookies in the world. Yeah, it's not good for you. Or pie crust made with lard. It's really bad for you. Ideally, everyone would eat 2 servings of fish a week. It's a little tough living here. Fiber, I always say our friend fiber, it's not just for your gut, but it also actually has been shown to help keep cholesterol and blood sugar down. Everyone should be getting about 5 servings a day of fruits and vegetables. Juicing is not good for us. All it does, especially fruit juices, I don't care how expensive your juicer is, it's breaking down all the cell walls of the fruit. It's releasing all the sugar. So I was going to buy a juicer a few years ago, did some research and found out, you know what, we can save a whole lot of money and eat a piece of fruit. So sodium, you want to try to stick to around 2,400 milligrams a day. Back when I started working in ICU, that was considered a low-sodium diet. But because we have so much added salt in our food sources now, it's now considered kind of the upper limit we should have. And it is amazing if you start reading food labels how much sodium there is in products, even stuff that's labeled healthy. Sometimes they've cut out the sugar or the fat, but they've added a whole lot of salt to make up for it. Potassium is actually a good source. It's good for our heart function. Fish, potatoes, corn, raisins. Again, too much sugar is not good for any of us. We know that. Those omega-3 fatty acids, and those come in fish and plants. And that's why fish and plant-based diets tend to be healthier. And again, vitamin D supplementation. There's been a lot of information out there about prevention of PIH, but also looking at it with heart disease and other conditions. Okay. I'm just going to finish up this a little bit and we're going to be done. So other therapies, again, we talked about physical activity. Duration is more important than the pace. So, you know, you don't have to be a marathoner. Managing stress. And, you know, I think more and more as we go into our future lives, that is so true. You know, think about now you can get apps on your phone. You can get all sorts of relaxation aids, and I think it behooves probably everyone. Vitamin D and calcium in adequate amounts. Lutein, which is found in egg yolks and green leafy vegetables, it's been associated with minimizing blood clots, things like that. That's a change in thinking. For a long time, if somebody had high cholesterol, oh, they were told they could never eat eggs again. That's not true anymore. Garlic, and again, that's why Mediterranean-based diets are good for us. So Greek food, Italian food, North African, Spanish food, anything that uses a lot of garlic can tend to be healthier. Just don't do what I did this fall, which I found this new recipe, and I thought, oh, a little garlic's good. I'll add a whole lot more. And, like, we got done, and we said, wow, it's good. We're not going anywhere the rest of the day because you could tell we'd had garlic. Again, fiber. It's not just for the gut. And you're seeing a lot of use of statins, and right now those recommendations stand. Just about all adult diabetics are on statins, is my understanding. Okay, I think I know what this one is, if I can get there. Okay, I just want to quick finish up. The symptoms of MI in women are different than men. And it's important to recognize this because for a long time, it wasn't being caught either in primary care or in the ER. Women were not being treated as aggressively for heart disease and they were dying. But what's important to know, so the classic signs, you know, and anybody in here work in the ER ever? Okay, so you sometimes see those people come in with chest pain and it's that classic, you know, feeling like there's an elephant on their chest. They are so diaphoretic that you can't get tape to stick to them. They're a color of gray you don't like to see. That's pretty classic. Maybe nausea, vomiting, shortness of breath. Women, it's not so much that way. Sometimes it's just an extreme amount of fatigue. Well, that's hard to catch because who isn't tired? Sometimes it's this vague nausea that they attribute to indigestion. They may just come in saying, oh, I just felt like my heart was beating faster. Or, you know, I'm just this vague anxiety. They may report trouble sleeping in the month up to the actual time of having an MI. So you want to get a good history on these women. And I can tell you that in the past, a lot of times women were told, it's just your nerves. Here's something for that. Go home. We're getting a lot better. We're now seeing women specifically treating other women in cardiology and cardiothoracic surgery. So I think it's something that we needed to come to terms with and recognize. Next. See, my mouse driving ability is getting worse. So it's about time to be done. Okay, let's stop here. So next week we'll pick up here. We'll do a quick overview of genetics and talk about neonatal abstinence and finish up any last lingering issues. So I will see you guys. Well, I'll see some of you tomorrow. So group A is A and B. I'll get a schedule on D2L tonight for what time you should come. Yeah, if you've got your badges, I'll take them. Otherwise, don't forget next Monday, bring your badges when you're done. There you go.
Yep.
I have to keep going with my first day.
Me too.